Hello, and welcome to another edition of Big Mouth, where the artisan, handmade pop culture conversation is always served piping hot. My name's Andrew Harrison, and I will be your server for the affair. With me, as ever, I have two quality guests from the world of entertainment journalism. Joe Muggs is a long-time writer for Mixmag, Q Magazine, Boiler Room, and in the lost mists of time, good old Word Magazine. Joe is London's Mr. Abstract Electronica and Ambient, and also London's elected Grime Commissioner, with additional connections in the world of classroom music that sounds like knives being dropped down a cellar. And he's also a great big science nerd. Hello, Joe. How are you?
Bleak as ever.
Bleak as ever.
Bleak these days.
Keep it light. This is a partridge. This is a partridge job. What's going on in the world of music that sounds like knives and forks being dropped down the stairs these days?
All sorts of exciting things. I'm just going to shamelessly self-plug. I've got an NTS radio show where I play the most brain-destroying ambient music imaginable at 5 a.m. on a Wednesday night.
So I thought the purpose of ambient music was not to destroy your brain, but to kind of heal and soothe it, like a load of Ambre Solaire on the cortices.
Well, the bleak music for bleak times.
Yes. Okay, people, keep listening. Also with us is Mark Hooper, veteran of the Face and Arena magazines, now at the forefront of the handmade crafts movement with Hole and Corner magazine. He's just been telling me how they've just done a spoon carving workshop. Mark, hello, how are you?
Yeah,
tell us about the spoon and tell us about the bloody results of the spoon carving workshop.
Walking cliche, yeah. So, we sort of focus on sort of craftsmanship, and it doesn't have to be sort of a... Luddite type things, but we did put on a big spoon carving event weekend down in brilliant sort of a Griswold fact, the oldest and largest thatched building in Britain, Messams in Wiltshire. But luckily it was a really good success. We were told we were guaranteed to have some serious injuries and to know the quickest route to A&E. It all went brilliant. We had about 150 to 200 people. All like using very, very sharp, dangerous knives. And the only person we managed to maim was one of your previous guests from last week, the bassist from Girl Ray, who...
We played Girl Ray last week. It was on our double Laura cast. And so you managed to inflict proper bass injury.
She was meant to be the entertainment for the evening, and then obviously, ironically, cut her finger, so couldn't play her instrument.
So what did she
just
do?
In time. Well, she spent most of the afternoon in A&E getting stitched up, and then she came back just in time and played the wooden spoon, because she had plenty of them.
So you've been listening to Me and My Spoon on private eye radio there.
Was it a Geezer Butler type instrument that's going to kind of impact on her playing and change her style?
Yeah, exactly. I think, it's going to be as well.
Tony Iommi,
Tony Iommi, Steel Press.
I suppose this is the inauguration of the, taken out of the band in a bizarre spoon carving incident that, forget gardening. Also with us, as ever, you heard him just then, maintaining our peaks and troughs and manicuring our sonic profile is the Shep Pettibone of podcast. It's Matt Hall. Hello, Matt. How are you?
Hello. If I'm Shep Pettibone, does that make you Madonna?
No, I'm the Latin Rascals. All on my
Look at those razor blades on the table.
Absolutely, yes. Have you been getting through the international football break, Matt?
I quite enjoy the international football break.
Yes, as a Manchester United fan, you're quite glad that Premier League football is off at the minute.
I'm also enjoying the giddiness that's coming from the other end of the of the East Lancs Road at the moment.
You know, happy times. It can't all be bleak, can it? Anyway, we're going to start with a film for a change. On first sight, Denis Villeneuve's Arrival is a science fiction film. It's an invasion film. It shows the sudden appearance on planet Earth of 12 vast oval spacecraft. They just turn up and they just hang there in the air, as Douglas Adams says, like bricks don't. So Army General Forrest Whitaker, Press Gang's linguist Amy Adams, and General Purposes science guy Jeremy Renner into attempting to communicate with what's inside. It's a complex, grown-up movie, and it really is worth talking about. Also, the very Sigur Rossi music by Icelandic composer Johan Johansson is quite integral to the general sense of alienness. To get you in the mood, from the soundtrack to Arrival, here is Heptapod B. Okay, that was Heptapod B and Rakim from the soundtrack to Denis Villeneuve's new first contact movie, Arrival. Don't sweat the technique. My mate wondered whether Arrival was about ABBA, but in fact, we thought it could be called The Visitors as well, because it fits quite well. This is one of those rare movies that you really can't talk about properly without totally ruining it. So we're going to do something a bit different this week. We're going to do a little mini podcast after this one, full of spoilers, where we actually talk about what happens in a way that you will obviously want to enjoy and think about when if you've actually seen the film. You can hear it at audioboom.com. Just search for Big Mouth. So, Mark Hooper, without spoilers, what did you make of Arrival?
I thought it's one of those films that you keep thinking about after you've seen it, and obviously I knew I was going to be talking about it, so probably more than usual, but it's obviously, it sort of goes out of its way to be an intelligent sci-fi movie, but I think it really works. It's very sort of media snob way of describing complicated films, but it's very non-linear, and I think for once it's deliberately like that. I mean, yeah. It's quite hard to explain that part of the plot.
Yeah, without ruining the film, it's hard to explain,
And the way it's filmed, it's very reminiscent of Terrence Malick, I thought, the way that it kind of, you know, there's a lot of nature in for a sci-fi film and zooming in on tiny details of a blade of grass, and there's lots of kind of semi-dream flashback sequences, which is more about family life than anything to do with sci-fi. And it's really, you know, you can kind of get really hooked in, sort of meditative in a way. Yeah. And really entrancing, I thought. Yeah.
The first person that the American military call upon is a linguist in order to communicate with these creatures. What you think is a kind of an entry point to the film actually starts to matter an awful lot more. Joe, did you enjoy the film? What did you make of it?
I enjoyed it massively. There were a couple of points early on where they kind of signpost this language versus science thing. Yes. And I thought, oh God, it's all going to be shoehorned in and everything's going to be telegraphed. Actually, it was really subtle. It was really well done, and the fundamental crux twist magic science point in the middle worked. I don't think it will stand up to much scientific analysis, but if you compare it to something like the god awful Interstellar, where they got scientific advisors a go-go and tried to really ladle on the science, and actually it didn't work. They just did it with a lightness of touch, and it was somehow it's about its own narrative. You know, it's one of those like meta kind of narratives, right, just elegant. The whole structure and plot is elegant.
I mean, one of the great things about it, I thought, was it totally flips the conventional first contact thing, and it actually brings in the cliche of the army wanting to attack them and then deals with it and shows the futility and pointlessness of it. Mm-hmm. It isn't, you know, I thought to an extent, there's one big bit with explosions, and I thought it kind of resonated a little bit with, I mean, obviously, if you've seen, I don't think this is a massive spoiler to say that, you know, the arrival of the aliens causes massive chaos across the world.
Because there's a dozen of them, isn't there, that are floating kind of in
different
areas.
Parts. We don't know
why. My favourite bit was there was one, they had, as usual, there's over different continents, and the one over the UK was over Devon. And
I know. A warm glow in your heart.
My home county.
I mean, it's worth saying that this is, it's quite funny because it's exactly the same starting premise as Warren Ellis's Trees comic, which is ongoing at the moment. And goes in a very different direction. It's interesting to read that alongside it.
Can I just say I was really disappointed that she wasn't the Cylon after our first opening bit in her house, when she's basically in Gaius Baltar's house from Battlestar Galactica.
Well, those are the kind of houses that people live in science fiction, aren't they? Things with big windows can stand by the window contemplating Earth and what it's going to be like when it's a big old cinder.
Oh, if you're into interiors porn, it's really good.
It's totally interiors porn.
Even the interior of the army tent is great.
Yeah, but I thought that, you know, as a first encounter film, it's essentially, you know, the incredible update on what is basically Close Encounters of the Third Kind, what would it be like to encounter aliens. I thought it was incredibly powerful. And you see the whole of planet Earth go into societal breakdown. You see civil liberties chucked out the window. And you see people falling back, not on reason, but on their politics. You see, who's in charge? It's the CIA. What's that got to do with interplanetary relations? But, you know, the man from the CIA is in charge. Weirdly, and probably I'm the only person who'll think of this, it reminded me of, there was a Torchwood series called Children of Earth, where basically this happens.
And you are the only person.
I am the only person, But it was, you know, monsters in the fog. We're not really sure what they want. Joe, did you think it was quite pertinent to Trump world then? I think you might have mentioned this.
I mean, it is. It was cathartic, and in a sense, it was wish fulfillment.
It's literally xenophobic, isn't it?
It's all about characters, xenophobia versus, well, let's face it, love. It's a film with love at its heart, and this is a wonderful thing, and it's nice.
Love is the message.
Love is very much the message.
I never understand though why the first thing that happens in an invasion or a first contact movie is the military pile in and point tanks at the spaceship. Have they ever actually seen any space films? That never works out well. You know, if they'd actually, the military high command that's war gaming for the eventual arrival of aliens has ever watched any movies, then they will turn up with a buffet, perhaps some flowers, a lot of art and music. Look, this is who we are. Please don't, you know, destroy us.
If you've got a 1500 meter egg that can defy gravity, it could probably beat off most of your weapons.
It probably because I
did think Forrest Whitaker was really impressive in that sense, though, because he was kind of the military figure, and you think, oh, here, and particularly being him. And funnily enough, I just watched Ghost Dog on just late night TV the other day, which I love. And I was kind of thinking, like, oh, Forest Whitaker's going to be this gung-ho. They've obviously cast him because he's slightly different, but he's going to be the one going. And he was actually the calming influence. And it was kind of interesting.
He does that kind of downbeat, seen it all before.
Exactly.
Yeah. Oh, my God, what's going to happen now? Well, doesn't it?
See, that was the only bit that didn't ring true for me, because what... odd things...
You wanted Dr. Strangelove.
No, odd things stand out. And what stood out to me was... Why are the army being so rude to Amy Adams? She's a civilian. You know, he's frog marching her around as if she's already conscripted. And I thought that was actually cliched, the idea that the army has seen it all before. Well, this is one thing that they haven't. They absolutely have not seen giant eggs hovering over Montana.
How do you know?
Well, they're obviously hiding it from us, aren't they, Matt? And if you look, avoid the mainstream media, we'll know all about this. What did we make of Amy Adams' performance? Because I thought she was fantastic and super restrained.
I saw one critic, you know, papers, Sunday papers critic, who wrote a name really laid into it, and I just thought that was probably more about
would it. Would it be that Sunday Times critic who really lays into things that everybody likes for its own sake? Yeah. What a surprise.
The one who said we should be upset about Bowie dying, I think.
Yeah, and Daniel Blake and so forth. So I read this week that the economist Paul Mason, a big fan and a big favourite of yours, Joe, he was writing that he's a born-again Corbyn fan. He wrote a piece this week saying, attacking escapism and blockbusters and superhero movies and animation, he said, you know, we should be tackling the reality of the modern world. Isn't he missing the point? You know, this in a weird way, Arrival is actually tackling the reality of what it is to be a human being, to be, you know, what your hopes and dreams are, and what happens to them if something totally out of your experience arrives.
I mean, I know this is the kind of standard response to sci-fi and kind of other genre movies, like, you know, westerns or whatever, is that, you know, they tackle the big questions and the big kind of points about kind of humankind, which is true, and I accept, but for a large number of people, they'll just be coming out. I think we'll be coming out of that movie going, "Why didn't Forest Whitaker fly a plane into the alien spaceship and punch them on the nose?" You know,
we see somebody try to do that, and it's futile. We see the stock response, and it actually not only is it futile, it's a relatively minor plot point.
Well, that's what I mean. It's a relatively minor plot point.
The interesting thing about that as well, it was kind of soldiers who are radicalised on the internet as well.
Yes.
Interesting.
Yeah. But if there's a core message, and I'm phrasing this very carefully to avoid the spoilers, but if there is a take-home message that clearly they want, it says something about why we do the things we do, even in the face of possible hopelessness.
Yeah.
And I felt, you know, it's a weepy, it's a sad film, but it gives you that kind of hopeful take-home message, I think.
Well, I think that, it shows you the truth about really good science fiction, with it's actually not about space and robots and alien planets, it's about human beings. Mm-hmm. But we're going to talk about it in a spoilery way, where we get into some of the minutiae in a little extra mini podcast, which you can listen to after this if you like. Go to audioboom.com/channel/bigmouth, and it'll be there, as well as all of our old shows that you can indulge in. But first, let's have a bit of music. As ever, we ask our guests to bring in their current earworm, the tune they're enjoying at the minute, and editor's recommendation, if you like. Mark Hooper, what have you got for us?
Commons Black America Again, which I just think is, funnily enough, we're going to discuss something else which has got very similar themes, and I just think, you know, we've been sort of waiting for someone to tackle this subject in a proper way, and I saw it actually first time I saw him perform this live on Jimmy Kimmel, which was unbelievable, not only because he managed to do the most perfectly choreographed handshake with Questlove while he was playing the congas. I kept rewinding, how did you not miss a beat while you're doing that? But yeah, it's just really, really powerful.
Okay, well, let's have a listen. This is Common with Black America Again.
Here we go again. Trayvon will never get to be an older man. Black children, they
sound. What and who he is? And where he come from? And where he come from?
We are rewriting the Black American story.
That was Common with Black America Again, the choice of MC Mark Hooper. As ever, we have a room full of white guys talking about hip-hop, and let's stick with that. Pretty much, I think, probably the most warmly awaited record of the autumn is A Tribe Called Quest's final record, their first proper album in 18 years. We got it from here. Thank you for your service. Is their last record with founder member Fife Dog, the funky diabetic who sadly succumbed to that illness this year, aged only 45. In the nature of hip-hop, Fife is actually on the album, and they couldn't have picked a more appropriate time to put it out. Pretty much much coinciding with Donald Trump's election victory, Black Lives Matter, and everything that hip-hop has ever talked about coming back into focus. Let's have a taste of We Got It From Here. Thank you for your service. This track is Black Spasmodic.
Yo, y'all ready? Yo, fight. You ready? Cons, you got that part, right?
I don't know, but it don't matter who choose to set it off.
Buzz the whole calendar.
Black.
Used to sell drugs out the Challenger.
Spasmodic.
Used to keep guns with the silencers.
Black.
A Tribe Called Quest with Black Spasmodic from their new and final album. We Got It From Here. Thank you for your service. Matt, you're a Tribe Called Quest head. What did you make of this record?
It's really sad. It's brilliant. And I think it fits within the Tribe Called Quest oeuvre without being... Some albums, you know, you would say that kind of Dr. Dre's Compton, which was a similar kind of return after a similar period of silence, kind of ladled in the guest stars and felt like a bit of a coda to his career. This just feels really strong and a really vibrant album. I think that, you know, the guest stars are not ladled in to make people buy the album. They actually kind of fit there quite well. There was an interesting thing that I read that they recorded the album, very unlike a lot of hip-hop albums are recorded at the moment, in that they recorded it at Q-Tip's studio in Long Island, and all the guest stars had to go to the studio.
So it's not just files turning
so
up on Dropbox.
So it's not just your MP3s and slot this in where you can on the in the program. So everybody was kind of vibing from each other, and, you know, tracks recorded kind of nearly live or as live as possible in hip-hop, with things being dropped in kind of organically. And I think you really get the sense of that.
Black Spasmodic that we just played is one of the more playable on the radio tracks, because 25 years in hip-hop hasn't blunted them down or calmed them down at all. This one is full of righteous anger and that sort of strange jazzy tunefulness that they're really well known for. Joe, this sounds... It's both a hip-hop record and it feels like not a hip-hop record. It feels like, you know, kind of a what's going on for right now. It's arrived at exactly the right time, hasn't it?
Yeah, I mean, it's the worst cliche of all to say that tough times give us great music. But certainly in Black American music, we've got a really strong streak. I mean, you put this alongside the Solange album, alongside Lemonade, alongside Kendrick album. You know, these are radical statements. They're statements of strength and community and exciting things. I mean, I'm not a hip-hop and soul traditionalist. I think that actually some of the, even what people might see as trashier modern hip-hop, Young Thug and Race Remmed and Gucci Mane and stuff, are actually as political and provocative in their way and are as important. And I don't want to kind of suggest, oh, it's the old heads showing the youngsters how to do it. But yes, there was always a maturity to Tribe Called Quest anyway, going back to the very beginning, and God, it feels like we need them more than ever now.
I thought it's weirdly predictive as well, because the track We The People, which we can't play because it's full of terrible swearing, but the chorus, with you know, all you black folks, you must go, Muslims and gays, boy, we hate your ways, it just feels like they wrote it like last week to hit the mood of the moment. And also, there's another line in there, Trump and SNL, hilarity, troublesome times, kid, no time for comedy. You know, that just made me feel how much the... You know, the entire world of, you know, TV comedy and the arts in general just totally dropped the ball and failed to do anything about the massive wave of change that's just gone through America.
Apart from sort of smug liberal comedians
who think
that zingers will change the mind of middle America, which they won't.
That's exactly what they're saying. You know, Mark, are you a Tribe Called Quest head?
I am. Since time? Massively, massively, man. Mm. And it's interesting what you're saying. That really struck me when I first listened to it. When Tribe Called Quest first came out, and there was a lot of that sort of Daisy Age and De La Soul, who all just come back recently as well. They were kind of seen as a sort of flip side to what, ironically, white conservative America was complaining about, this kind of hate speech. And now it takes Tribe Called Quest to come back and point out that who the people who are actually responsible for all this hate speech is, you know, and sort of having a song against Donald Trump politics. And, you know, it just really, you know, it really sort of struck me quite deeply. And the one thing I was quite upset was that the final track, The Donald, isn't actually about Donald Trump.
No, it's really actually... Well, I thought that was great, because that's actually about Five Dog, isn't it? Because his nickname was like, you know, Don Juice or something, the Don of Juice. And this track is just, as a radio announcer, repeated over and going, The Donald, The Donald, The Donald. But I actually like the idea that on the last track, on your last album, what you're saying is that your mate is more important than Donald Trump. I thought, too right. That's a good thing to say.
And they also deal, you know, rather brilliantly on the penultimate track with the whole kind of... is hip-hop just talking about itself. It's called Ego, and it's basically saying, we're really brilliant, and, we're off. See you later.
I think that's a wonderful thing about it, because as well as being full of, you know, self-confidence, and actually really, for all of the stuff it's about, it's really celebratory and optimistic, and actually very funny as well. There's a track called Space Program, which is basically, why isn't there a space program for, quote, African-Americans? Obviously, they don't say African-Americans. You know, why can't we get off this planet? Kind of thing. But also, it's really tender. I mean, the track about, you know, this couple of tracks about Fife dying, it's kind of heartbreaking, and it's the sort of thing I suspect you can't make that music when you're 22. Well, when you're 45 and 46 and stuff is happening to you, it is, you know, it comes from the heart a little bit.
Well, it's
more.
A reunion album, you know. I mean, the last Tribe album was the Love Movement, which kind of most people think is probably their weakest record, and after that they split up because Fife got the rumours are, and there's a film, a documentary, which details kind of how they broke up.
Yeah.
Fife got kind of pissed off with the view that the general view that he was Q-Tip's kind of sidekick and not able to do anything in his own career, which unfortunately was, apart from one kind of quite good album that got released on a German label, was kind of proven after he left. But it's a reunion, so he's him and Q-Tip are back together, but also Jarobi, who has never actually apparently appeared, who was always the fourth member of A Tribe Called Quest, who never actually appeared on an album before, but kind of except in skits. Rather brilliantly, he's been his career previously to this consisted of running a hip hop chef business called Eats Rhymes and Life.
Oh,
which
wow.
which I think you would probably be pleased of, wouldn't you?
Oh God, yeah.
It's basically it's a hip hop cookery pop up. Which is what he's been doing for the last 15 years.
I mean, I live near Dalston. Where is my hip hop cookery pop up? Where is it? I demand
he does,
it.
He does. One of the things he does restaurant remixes, where he goes into restaurants for an evening, takes all of the ingredients that the restaurant has on their kind of regular menu, and cooks something different with it. Which means that the restaurant doesn't have to buy. Yeah.
Does he just hand you a plate with a potato on it and say, "This is the dub"? It's the Beta Pella.
Yeah.
So we talked about the De La Soul album earlier this year, and it is a really brilliant record. Are we getting into the stage now where kind of elder statesmen of hip-hop are able to make their kind of mature statements? Are we going to get the LL Cool J Johnny Cash album talking about life from an older guy's
perspective? Well, I don't know if I mentioned, if I said this, but I've had a theory knocking around for a few years. The interesting, black American music traditionally has genres and styles which you can grow old in, whether it's kind of jazz or blues, that, you know, you have elder statesmen, OAPs, working that kind of music. And hip-hop has not dealt with that very well because it's been a kind of angry young person's music. I think you're starting to get that. And, you know, there's people like Joe Budden as well who are kind of doing stuff from a more mature point of view. And I think that's a really good thing.
I think you probably say the same about rock. You know, it's amazing it's taken the Rolling Stones this long to work out that they should probably behave like the heroes and record a blues album now that they're in their 70s, you know.
Yeah. Let's talk for a minute about A Tribe Called Quest appearing on Saturday Night Live, which was quite a thing, wasn't it? They did We the People, and for Fife's first, they unveiled a giant banner of Fife.
Yeah.
And they stood there and they just, like, saluted this voice from beyond. It's incredible how, you know, in Britain, no matter how popular it's been, hip-hop has always been a subculture, a subgenre, hasn't it? It's always been a kind of a massive cult. Whereas in America, it is now, and has been for 20 years, like the authentic voice of what everybody's talking about.
Well, the thing that struck me about that the first time you see Q-Tip on that Saturday Night Live performance, I just thought Jimi Hendrix. He's basically channeling rock god. He's got a leather kecks, kind of massive brimmed, kind of one of those flat hats that Hendrix used to wear. Kind of looking kind of quite grizzled, goatee beards. They all had, everyone has leather jackets on. And they they just rocked it.
It's quite Michael Jackson Bad video, isn't it, really? It's like bizarrely 80s.
Yeah, yeah.
Unexpectedly so. But last week we were talking about how the British press seems to think there's no protest music anymore. And as Joe's just pointed out, you knee deep in it, your throat deep in it. Yeah. It's really, really good at the minute. This record, how are we finally going to assess it? Because I sort of feel I'm not very qualified to talk about hip-hop anymore. I'm well out of the game, but this sounds like a record of the year to me. Sounds like one of the ones that we'll be talking about in 6 weeks' time.
It deserves to be up there, 100%. I mean, you know, we haven't said much about the music, but, I mean, As Matt said, it sounds really live. It sounds like people cutting the beats. You know, there'll be a DJ cut, and the beats will go slightly out of time, or a dub echo that seems slightly out of time. They've left those mistakes in, and that just makes it sound even better. Loads of reggae, as you could hear on that track. Loads of, I think there's two different Can samples on the.
There's
album.
Also Musical Youth, the venerable This Generation sample is there, which always warms the heart.
And the thing that made me most sad of all, and I know there's loads of bits of Fife and kind of eulogies to him all over the record, was the sample from the original Charlie's Chocolate Factory with Gene Wilder doing the Nobody Knows Where We're Going speech, which was kind of really quite sad. Yeah.
And there's a bit of Umpalumpas in there as well, isn't there?
Yes. But crucially, it doesn't sound old. It actually doesn't sound hoary and old. I mean, you know, the production is super, super crisp. It sounds quite digital. It doesn't sound like, you know, old, venerable hip-hop DJ with his dusty jazz samples at all. It really sounds like it's fresh. They're enjoying it. It's they're listening to new music. They're listening to electronic music. It listens to all sorts of different things, obviously. So
Well, I just keep going back to it over and over again, and you know, I'm still, you know, finding new weird things in it. It's fantastic. Okay, let's move on to another musical thing. Let's have another editor's recommendation. Joe Muggs, what have you got for us?
Catherine Williams, one of my favourite singers, Scouser, I believe. She has the purest voice and some incredible songwriting chops. Her new album is a covers album, though. She tends to go for very interesting conceptual things. Her last album was about the life of Sylvia Plath. So cheerful singer. But this one is a cover of standards. She's never been a jazz singer, but she's worked with this vibes player and done very, very, very stripped back. And you were talking about escapism.
Yeah.
And I think a lot, at this time of year anyway, I start to make playlists of staying indoors music. And, you know, I do a lot of playlists on Spotify. And actually, I had just had this thought about soft music for hard times.
Yeah.
And you know, I've been talking to friends about how actually slow soul or ambient music or whatever can be as important in difficult times. I mean, campaigners talk about self-care, and musical self-care is really important. It doesn't make you less challenging to the order to actually sit back and absorb yourself and just soothe your soul, and that's what this does.
Well, let's have a listen then. This is Catherine Williams doing My Funny Valentine. Chosen by Joe Muggs. This is going to be an album of jazz standards redone in avant-garde, dub, folktronic, who knows what style, and even I might like that. So, okay, carrying on and continuing with 2016's campaign to be the worst year in the history of humanity, this week we heard of the death of David Mancuso, founder of the New York club night, or private party, The Loft, and therefore, basically, John the Baptist to Paradise Garage, and therefore, pretty much the entirety of club culture and the dance world. Mancuso was much respected as the DJ's DJ, not so much for his mixing as for creating an atmosphere, choosing a repertoire, mixing audiences together, and what we would now call curating. He was a prime mover in disco, and then bridged the gap into the perhaps more serious-minded era of crate diggers, dance aficionados, and DJ culture. And there was a definite laid-back Mancuso loft sound, a mix of soul, funk, and electronics that anticipated Balearic Beat. Let's have a listen to one representative track, the kind of stuff he used to play. This is Sol Makossa by Manu Dibango. Makossa. Mamaku, mamasa, maku, makossa. Mamaku, mamasa, maku, makossa. Mamaku, mamasa, maku, makossa. Nana money, money, money. Manu Dibango with Sol Makossa, one of the signature tracks from David Mancuso's Loft Parties in New York. Now, obviously, we never got to go there because we're the wrong country and the wrong age. But, Joe Muggs, what did David Mancuso mean for dance music?
Pretty much everything. I mean, it's to my eternal regret that I haven't been to a Loft Party, because he brought it over to London as well with Tim Lawrence, who's also a great, essentially his biographer. He wrote Love Saves the Day, the history of disco in New York. And yeah, they've been doing loft parties up until very recently, and I now am kicking myself not to have gone. The weird thing was, when I was going raving in 1990, you know, when I was 16, none of us knew about the early days of disco at all. We knew about Frankie Knuckles, we knew about the Paradise Garage and Larry Levan. But before that, it somehow seemed like this kitschy world of flares and afros and such like. And it was only later, through meeting the kind of Balearic people, you know, seeing DJ Harvey and all these British people. There was a club in Brighton that I used to go to called Muffle Waffle that plugged into that world and had this direct inspiration from the loft stroke Balearic eclectic, laid-back, sophisticated playlist thing, that I started to discover this kind of year zero. And then you realise, actually, it goes back before even the loft, because Mancuso had been to Woodstock. He'd been, you know, proper 60s counterculture.
He was basically a hippie, wasn't he?
He was basically a hippie. I mean, he talked about higher vibrations and you know, all sorts of spiritual jargon all the time. But he, at the same time, you know, he was a tough Italian New Yorker who was streetwise and didn't mess about and just did everything, like... Well, did it properly.
Bada bing, bada boom.
And loved high-end electronics.
And really loved high-end electronics.
Loved the sound systems.
Speakers,
The loft predated disco, actually. We tend to think of it... people who know about it realise and understand that it wasn't a case of he was the thing that came after disco. He predated disco. He was kind of running concurrently with it. And sort of after disco burns out in a storm of, well, possibly overexposure and possibly kind of basic racist, homophobic slagging off on radio stations... He continued and you know, just kept developing it into what became house and so on.
He was certainly involved with the house movement and people that he worked with, like Francois Kevorkian. You know, they were there right through the 80s alongside the Frankie Knuckles and Larry Levans, you know, just nurturing the changing movement.
But in a way, he was very different from, you know, the guys that are legendary at the Paradise Garage, and in that, you know, he was all about the music selection to the extent that he didn't mix. Mm-hmm. He let a record finish, then he took it off and then he put another one on and started it. Mm-hmm. So there was a kind of gap in between each of the music.
And he would play records for 7-8 hours. He would play the sound of a thunderstorm, or he would play Beethoven if he felt like it as part of his warm-up. It was not all about beats. It was you know, he believed in the entirety of the party and the atmosphere.
And I think it was about kind of the way that he set up the venue, and the loft was his, you know, it started out in his loft apartment. It was essentially a kind of a paying party for him to raise money when he kind of wasn't earning much, but it was about the kind of the way he decorated it, the way he placed the speakers. The speakers which he placed, which were kind of like, apparently, like the most ridiculously perfect.
Clipsons, I believe.
A guy with no money with the most expensive speakers in the world is quite an inspiring thought. Mark, is this the, you know, how does this relate to what we now think of as Balearic music, do you think?
Well, I think, interestingly, like, exactly as Joe said, I kind of realised that a lot of particularly sort of club and dance music that I was into all came through Mancuso, and I didn't realise at the time. I was into the kind of, the second generation. And I mean, when I first moved to London, I actually had a job, unpaid, of course, above the Blue Note, which was, for me, that was kind of like my dream idea of a job. And I think it had that sort of loft feeling about it, where it was anything goes, and you'd go in there. And I remember a cousin of mine came from, you know, lives in Norfolk, and just couldn't believe the mixture of people in the club. He's like, he wasn't blind to the ways of the world or anything, but he's like, how come they're like fat balding indie guys and dreads and all these guys in one room listening to Speed Garage? You know, it doesn't make sense. They don't fit into any sort of genre. And it was, I love that. And even like, you know, now I tend to go to places like Heavenly Social, which is more of a pub, but I love the fact they have hip hop karaoke night with black kids, you know, queuing all the way down the street, and you go in there and there's still the old bearded white indie guys in there as well. And it's, you know, I think that's what makes London so great, and it's, you know, club culture at the moment, I think, can teach the world quite a lot of things.
Club culture still matters, and I mean, you know, it's got the current current political climate is turning me into a hippie.
Yeah.
something else to hate Donald Trump for. It's turning me into a hippie. But let's not forget that David Mancuso's first loft party was called Love Saves the Day. I mean, it was a cheap LSD gag in certain ways. But actually, again, it was about love. It was about, if you are willing to participate in the spirit of the thing, you're welcome, and it does not matter.
And you're going to mingle with
are.
People, because the truly dismal and miserable thing about the US election result was it just showed America dividing into groups that hate one another, and oppositionalism, and that
there was a really great story that I think Bill Brewster, DJ History, shared on Twitter of an interview with Mancuso talking about one of his parties which happened, and just as it started, the there was a blackout in New York, and so obviously all the music cut down. But they went and lit loads of candles, and they got loads of boom boxes, and they all tuned them into this one New Jersey station that was still going, and they just had a party. Kept going. And he said it was one of the best parties that he had, you know. Yeah. And I think that kind of inclusivity and that kind of, you know, you can be gay, you can be straight, you can be black, you can be Puerto Rican, it's something that, as Joe said, is the mark of the best clubbing experience.
Well, friend of the show Alexis Petridis wrote a really nice obituary in The Guardian where he pointed out that Mancuso didn't actually like clubs because they were too crowded and too noisy. And he thought that mixing ruined the integrity of the records. And at the end, he didn't even have headphones or mixers in the loft. But there's a fantastic story in there in Alexis's thing, possibly from Bill and Frank's book, but about how Mancuso was brought up in an orphanage. There's a lovely story about how one of the nuns, their sister Alicia, would have any excuse to put on a party. She used to get balloons, hand out juice, and play records. Sister Alicia invented raves. So we've got a nun to thank. Just sum it up, Joe. How would you describe the loft sound? Because there was a loft sound, wasn't there?
That's incredibly tough. I've been listening to Mancuso mixes all week and playlists people have put on Spotify of his favourite tracks and so on. And you know, it could be anything from Charlie Mingus to Depeche Mode. Mm. And it almost depended on context. It almost depended on the flow of his mix. So put the Charlie Mingus and the Depeche Mode next to each other doesn't work. But four records between them make them work as Mancuso records.
I've also been listening to loft mixes and also kind of retrospective loft playlists, and you're right, the styles and the genres are very different, but there is an emotional tone that runs through it, which tends to be optimistic, euphoric, thoughtful, laid back, and just generally energising.
But there can be melancholy as well. It's emotionally rich, generally musically sophisticated, but never full of noodling solos. Always just like pulled back a little bit from being OTT.
You do occasionally run into something that's a bit smooth jazz though, don't you?
You do.
Slightly cab driver smooth jazz 4 a.m, but you know.
And he's not shy of playing, you know, it's not obscurity either. He's absolutely was never shy about playing the big songs, the big Stevie Wonder song, the big Curtis Mayfield song, the big Depeche Mode song, you know. So it's not at all about snobbery, much as a lot of his disciples will pay £4,000 for a record that he played. But
well, we'll dig out some of those Spotify compilations that people around the world have been putting together of loft selections. You can have a listen yourself, and we'll put it on our Facebook page, which is facebook.com/BigMouthUK. Very hard to reconcile this guy with the world of Calvin Harris and Steve Aoki, isn't it? Anyway, thank you, 2016. Please hurry on out of the door. Okay, we are coming to the end of the show, so it's time for Closing Time Chatter, where our guests pass on the story or the idea or the feature that's been obsessing them this week. Mark Hooper, I believe you've been thinking about Zadie Smith.
I have, yeah. I watched NW on BBC Two this week, the adaptation of a book, obviously. And I think it seemed really timely.
What's it about? Just give us a summary.
It's a story of three lives, essentially, growing up in northwest London, hence NW. Two kids who went to school together, two girls, a white girl and a black girl, basically. The black girl ends up becoming a lawyer, almost forgets her past in her attempt to sort of climb the ladder, but it deals with that really well and why she has to do that. And, you know, it's not just, you know, it's not an entirely positive story. And there's a very kind of Balladian sort of, she wants to kind of escape from her perfect life and her perfect husband as well. So she kind of gets involved in some nastiness. And then her white best friend from when they were kids, who stayed very working class, close to her roots. And then there's another kind of random character who basically, you don't really see what the connection is. He's quite an engaging. It was actually kind of, I thought, the kind of one of the more interesting castings, really good. And when I actually saw the advert, and I thought it was Craig David, which was quite exciting. I was like, oh, this guy can act. And then I realised it wasn't. But basically he gets stabbed. I don't think it's too much of a plot spoiler, so it's because it's quite a key point, and the connection is that this kid who stabbed him has connections with all the other people. And I think really it kind of made me think of this kind of post-Brexit world we live in, and kind of brought home that it's not just America that's having problems at the moment, but at the same time, the way it portrayed, you know, it's the London I know. You live cheek by jowl with all classes, all races, all religions, and even though there's obviously, you know, stabbing is a main part of the film, the thing that really struck me is like there's this really, really close relationship between these two girls, and it's kind of, you know, you think people talk about what Englishness or Britishness is. And I know this is quite hypocritical and cliche-ridden, but I tend to think of Britishness as being polite, having a sense of fair play, all that sort of stuff. Inclusiveness, like we're talking about, club culture, and, you know, looking out for the small guy and stuff. And that's, if you write all those words down, not one of them applies to Nigel Farage. So who is he to say he's standing up for British values, you know?
Yeah, so essentially it's the bonfire of the vanities of
exactly,
Brexit,
yeah,
is
very,
what you're saying.
Similar, yeah,
okay.
Yeah.
Joe? What's on your closing time chatter agenda here?
It's such a small thing, but we, you know, you take your small pleasures where you can these days. The news yesterday that Millie Bobby Brown, a.k.a. 11 from Stranger Things,
yes,
and Maddie Ziegler, the young dance prodigy, first known for being in the gloriously trashy cable show Dance Moms.
Oh, yeah.
About a dance class and the pushy moms who get their daughters into it. And then more recently, mega, mega famous because she's in all the Sia videos from Chandelier onwards. The news that these two are now showbiz bezzies.
Right.
They're great, great friends.
But are they about 12 years old? Well,
they're both about 12, I think, yeah. And this news, as a dad of a daughter who's a fighter and feisty and likes physical activities and who I want to grow up as with the right ambitions, just seeing these two, they're the role models I want to see. Maddie Ziegler is the most extraordinary dancer. You see her in these Sia videos, and she's not just technical, she's expressive, she's an artist. It's just the most incredible thing. And I don't know much about Millie Bobby Brown beyond the fact that she memorises loads of rap verses and obviously plays this incredible, tough, nose-bleeding, psychic monster creature.
In Stranger Things, yes.
But you know, she presents something that isn't a princessy vision at all. Shaved-headed, nose-bleeding child. Yeah.
Well, I can give you another exciting fact about Millie Bobby Brown.
I knew you were
she's a Liverpool FC fan. She's a Liverpool FC fan. So she's among the righteous and the saved.
Well, there you go.
Well, so there's basically something to look forward to. The farewell, Kardashians, and hello, some good, admirable people.
Let them be the new celebrities. You know, it's you hope for the future. The kids are all right. That's my little feeling for the week.
That's good stuff, Matt. I believe you were thinking about Dave Chappelle's Saturday Night Live.
Yeah, I mean, Joe mentioned earlier, and we talked about kind of people saying that the political situation has kind of caused people in music have been responding to it. Interestingly, Saturday Night Live, the most important thing that happened this year basically was Dave Chappelle coming out of like 13 years, a long time of self-imposed exile, after he famously walked off his HBO series halfway through series 3 because he just decided he didn't like doing that anymore. But he came back, and after making the kind of obvious, it's been quite a while, will you bear with me crack about his rustiness, just proceeded to kill it from a kind of stand-up point of view. The monologues at the start of SNL have been can be quite hokey, not very well scripted, kind of quite often presented by actors who aren't particularly good at kind of stand-up. And to see this guy who is just in total command of his craft and using that to kind of talk about quite unpalatable truths was just brilliant, I think, and kind of more power to his elbow. Plus, he got a Tribe Called Quest on by inviting them personally. So
fantastic. Yeah. Well, my closing time chatter is I've got a new job. I'm editing a new website called The Question, where we collect answers from the general public and we go to experts and specialists and academics to get them answered. And we're finding out all kinds of weird things, like the phrase, you can't sing for toffee. It was originally, you can't do it for nuts, because toffee wasn't sufficiently common enough. It's like, you know, that guy, he can't sing for nuts. And also things like the Earl of Sandwich didn't actually invent the sandwich. It was originally known as a piece. Would you like a piece?
that kind of puts a different spin on kind of a hip-hop top lyric where I'm going to pull out my piece and wet you.
Absolutely, we? Yeah. Oh, mayonnaise everywhere. Thousand Island dressing all over the shop. So, yeah, we do that. We also do serious stuff like, you know, how much of a mafia state is Russia really, and what to do if somebody starts shooting at you. So have a look if you fancy it. It's The Question, which is the, and then QSTN.com. And that's obsessing me to fill in my every working hour. So there we go. End of plug. And also, end of show. Thanks to our guests. Thanks to Mark Hooper of Hole and Corner magazine, currently bringing spoon carving and other dangerous pursuits to the public. And Joe Muggs of Mixmag and The Guardian and lots of other different places like Boiler Room. Don't forget, you can hear our mini cast about the movie Arrival right now at audioboom.com/channels/bigmouth. We'll be doing all the spoilers, but of course only listen to it if you've actually seen the film. You can listen to this episode again and our archive at the very same place, or if you fancy, you can subscribe at iTunes. Just go to the iTunes music store, go into the podcast bit and search for Big Mouth. So that's another Big Mouth in the bag. We'll see you next week, and remember, be excellent to each other.